Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, hi, and welcome. I am your host, Emma Gunnar-Wardner, and in my nearly 20-year career as a beauty and health writer, I have interviewed a lot of people. Supermodels, entrepreneurs, authors, celebrities, and doctors. And many of these conversations had a real impact on me, and I'd come away feeling inspired, excited, informed, and really empowered. And at the back of my mind, I'd always think, I wish I could just publish the tape so people could really feel that conversation. Well, on this podcast, you get to feel the conversation. I talk with experts, guests, and a few friends who I hope will inspire, inform, and empower you, and maybe also challenge you, whether you're looking for self-help, self-improvement, beauty advice, health insights, business know-how, or just some good old-fashioned life advice and a bit of a laugh. It's all here. Welcome to the show. My guest in this episode of the podcast is author and writer Natasha Lunn, who joins me to talk about love. That's right, love. Now, I've known Tash for a few years now, from when we worked together on the same magazine, and I was always struck by her writing and her passion for certain topics, love being one of them. She really does have this fantastic ability to condense really intense thoughts, feelings into a couple of sentences in a way that is universally accessible. She is such a skillful writer. So it was of no surprise to me when I heard she had written a book about love in all its many forms, meanings, and feelings. But to be honest, I thought conversations on love might be a little bit above my pay grade. And for that reason, I actually danced around reading it for a little while. I was intimidated. I thought that there was no way I'd be able to get through a book on love because it would be too poetic, too lyrical, too cerebral. And that intimidated me, just going to be really honest about it. And also, on some level, I thought I knew what love was. So did I really need to do a deep dive into it? And listener, I'm so happy to tell you how wrong I was. It's one of the best books I've read in a long, long time, and it's one of my strongest recommends to everybody. Now, whenever I do see anyone, I'm like, oh, you must read this book. I really guarantee you're going to love it. And I'm so glad I read the book, because my biggest takeaway was that there is so much love everywhere, but often we take it for granted and just don't see it, feel it, or appreciate it, even though it might be standing right in front of us or staring us in the face. And part of it, I guess, is that we've been sold a version of what love looks like, this idea that real love is the notebook levels of obsession and desire. And in trying to notice that in our lives, we may miss the no less real love that surrounds us every single day. And actually taking the moments to appreciate that is what can be so wonderful and life-affirming and beautiful. And that's really the gift that the book gave me. And I don't know about you listeners, but I've definitely felt something along the lines of, I know I'm loved, but I don't feel loved before. And I've come to realize that's not because love isn't there, but because I was measuring everybody else's way of loving by my own definition. And therefore I was closing myself off to some wonderful experiences. And opening yourself up to how other people show their love is a way to form deeper and more significant connections. And Tash and I really dig into this and more in this episode, not just romantic love, but also friendships, self-love, the loss of love, the loss of friendships, the grief and heartbreak of friendships, the ideals of love, the roles of I and we in relationships, vulnerability and how that relates to love, the myth of the one, loneliness, and honestly, so, so much more. Like the book, I found the conversation with Tash really valuable, and I hope that you do too. And also, on a lighthearted note, please don't at me for screwing up the RuPaul quote. For the record, I do know that it's, if you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you going to love somebody else? But I just kept flubbing it up during the call. Blame the pressure of being on a live podcast. What can I tell you? I'm going to put the links to Tash and the book in the show notes, but please do join me in welcoming my friend Tash Lunn onto The Emma Gunn Show. Welcome to The Emma Gunn Show, Tash Lunn. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. As you know, I've been listening for so long, so I feel very excited to be a guest.
It's so funny because we were talking the other day, listeners. I've known Tash for a long time, and I said, I always had a funny feeling you would end up on the podcast because we met when we worked together on Red Magazine.
And I said to you, I always knew your podcast would be a big success. And even, you know, you always taken it so seriously. And I love being in the office with you talking about guests and ideas. And I could just tell that you were going to stick with it. And now here we are.
Here we are indeed. And we are talking about a subject that truthfully, I didn't know I needed to read about. I didn't know I needed to explore because you've written this wonderful book, Conversations on Love. And I thought, yeah, love, we all know what love is. Why do we need to explore it and redefine it? And then, listeners, I was just saying to Tash that I finished the book, which I read in two sessions in the park, which made it even more romantic. And it was as though by reading the book, the colours of the world got turned up to a much brighter, more vivid and vibrant setting. It did make the world feel like a kinder, lovelier place. And I guess I kind of understood, without wanting to sound like a wet, wet, wet song, that love is everywhere.
Can I steal that colours line for the paperback?
Of course you can. I'll write a little blurb for the back.
Yeah, I think your experience of reading it reflects my experience of writing it. And when I sat down, you know, the post-it note I had at the top is I wanted people to feel reading it the same things they might falling in love. So seen, understood, also challenged, sort of encouraging them to grow. So I'm just trying to mimic the feelings that you might feel in love as a reader. That was the aim.
Because I think we focus a lot, or I don't know, culture focuses a lot on the pursuit of love. So when I was sitting down this morning, I was thinking, what have I watched on television recently? What series have I watched? And they've all been about intensely passionate relationships, because I unfortunately watch Sex Life.
I haven't watched this. Everyone's talking about this.
Yeah, you definitely have to let me know what you think.
Okay.
But this sort of, this pursuit of this intense, intense love that's sort of so cataclysmic that it's life-changing. And we don't actually necessarily focus on the love that we already have, or normal in inverted commas love. And I felt that was what this book gives anyone who reads it the opportunity to really understand, explore and appreciate.
Well, Hilary Mantel said to me that authors can't help themselves, because the sort of structure of a tumultuous searching for love story, getting, you know, just as a narrative arc, it's more interesting and it's easier to write. And actually writing a slow, steady, changing love is just sort of on a functional basis much more difficult. So perhaps that's why we don't have as many stories about it. But I know in my life I have just found it very easy to obsess over the love I lack. And like in the book, I just talk about when you're standing in front of a vast painting, if you're too close to it, you can't see the scale of it. And I think that that's how we are with love. Like when it's too close, or when we have people every day, it can be difficult to see them in context of their separateness to us. And yeah, I'm embarrassed by how many times, like the example I use is I was always like checking my phone underneath the table when I was at dinner with my parents, you know, always just elsewhere, never really seeing that as a love story or seeing my brother as a love story. So part of writing the book was just trying to catch myself whenever I did that. And just, you know, one of the writers said to me, we all need reminders in life. So some people meditate, some people go for a run, some people do mindfulness, some people listen to podcasts like yours. And that's what the conversations became for me. It was like these reminders of saying, you know, even now when I just feel stressed and there's loads on my plate, I try to think what will matter at the end of all of our lives are people. And it is so obvious and so cringy, but it's something we forget every single day. And the second that something bad happens, or, you know, you get a piece of bad news and things are thrown, you know, you lose, you know what matters, and it's really obvious. But we just forget that very simple fact all the time. And of course, we can't walk around all the time thinking, you might die, so I love you so much. But I think there is a way that we can learn just to prioritize our relationships as much as we would our work or our health, was where I was trying to get to.
I think, yeah, you're absolutely right, isn't it? It's that investment in people. It's the first thing that can be forgotten or sort of slip to the bottom of that to-do list to do tomorrow, that then slips to the bottom of the to-do list, of actually just nourishing those connections.
And I think with me, it was realizing a lot of it was ego, and I was more concerned with career was about me succeeding, and even like looking for love was about finding someone to love me. And I've just learned that rather than like looking in so much, and of course we need to understand ourselves, but my kind of journey of love, if you like, was just to sort of point the lens back outwards and think, well, how do I give love? How do I focus on learning to give love as much as obsessing over finding someone to love me? And actually now I think that that I have found loving is, if not more, but equally as rewarding. And it's a big adventure loving another person. It's really complicated and it takes so much. But you know, when I see a friend now who I've known since I was at school, and I feel all the layers and depths of our friendship and all the years when we sort of drifted apart or had different experiences and couldn't understand each other through them, and then feel the way that we have come back together, it feels so rich, and I just feel lucky to get to contribute to those relationships. So it seems crazy to me that we would think we wouldn't have to try at that we can get this amazing, incredible thing just effortlessly, when we would never imagine to get our dream job without having to put in any effort.
Such a good point, isn't it? I think we've been soft served this idea of what love is by Hollywood and by storytelling, and as you say, for those obvious reasons. But also I think there's this which I think is dangerous a little bit, is a sense of being loved or being wanted or being accepted by somebody else is the answer.
Yes, and I feel that being with friends or with family or with a relationship, it's very difficult to be a good partner or daughter or friend if you don't understand yourself. And it's not really, I mean, you talk a lot with your, by the way, anyone, you should listen to Emma's podcast with Julia Samuel, because it's so good. But you were talking about self-love in that episode. And for me, I sort of punished myself for a long time because I didn't love myself. And so I thought nobody else is going to love me because I'm insecure. And somebody had said to me, like, insecurity is really unattractive quality. Mm-hmm. And I carry that around me for so long, because I was like, well, I can't rid myself of that. You know, I can't pretend that I never feel insecure. And now I understand that it's really about self-understanding, and no one can expect to love themselves wholly and completely all the time. And actually, that doesn't cut you off from having a romantic relationship. But if you were coming to that relationship assuming that it's going to fill all your holes and fix everything for you, it's going to be very difficult for that partner, loading all that expectation onto them. And I just don't think that you can enjoy a relationship as much. I just think one of the interviewees called it, Ayesha Malik, said to me, I don't know if you remember, that you just need lots of different people to love you in lots of different ways. And that even your parents, you know, from the beginning, you feel like they, you know, they've seen you from your baby, and they've seen they can't know all of you, and they can't always be there for you. Just as your friend can't, you know, answer every demand, or, you know, in a way we do when we're younger and they're there every day, you know, that's not going to be like a friendship in your 30s or 40s. So I think understanding that you need all these different people to know you in different ways and support you through different things is what can make all of your relationships stronger.
I think when I read that part of the book, I realized that I had a factory setting that I didn't even know that I had, which is almost sort of too intensely monogamous. And when you talk about that quote about you need a lot of people to love you in a lot of different ways, that feels like polyamory to me. And I'm like, oh, well, that doesn't seem right. I do think it's absolutely correct. But I definitely went on a pursuit of, I want a best friend who you don't even need to sort of say anything and they just know. And I want a partner to be like that as well. I want it to be, they are everything. And I think that probably explains why my relationships have failed in pretty sort of drastic ways, because it closes off a really beautiful experience of having lots of different connections.
Well, also, not that this should be the only reason to have lots of different people, because it's not all about your romantic relationship. But I've just been writing about this of Susan Quilliam, who's a relationship coach. She was talking to me about how, of all the couples she's seen, like the problem that underlies everything else is when people lose this balance between I and we. So either they're thinking so much as we that they've sort of lost themselves in the relationship, they've let the friends drift, they've just, everything is about being enmeshed as a couple and they don't have a life outside of the relationship. And when that happens, she said, that's when we can start to be mean to our partners and cruel to them, because you don't have enough distance. Like I was using the example of if my colleague was telling me a story that I heard before, I'd be polite because we're not so close that I can be mean. So I'll just sort of nod and pretend I haven't heard it. Whereas if my husband Dan told the story, I'd be like, oh, I've heard this one before. That's just a little example of how when you know someone really well, the security allows you to be a bit meaner to them. And so she said, if we lose the distance completely, we don't have any space or room for us to want to be kind to them or nice to them. And she also said, one of you might feel so claustrophobic that you want to assert your difference and sort of pull away and start to resent them. So that was one side of it. But then she said, if you think too much as I, you don't have a relationship, because you need to almost think about the other person's feelings in an argument and try and see their point of view rather than saying, why don't you do it like I want you to do it? So she said that's the constant balance. And I think in order to have the I part, you need to have other different types of relationships, because that's one way you can get the distance back. And also, certainly for me, there's parts of me that my husband doesn't know, but that we wouldn't talk about, that I would have with a friend. And I don't need him to be the person who I tell everything to, because I might have a friend who I talk to about conversations on love in depth, because he's interested because it's me, but not from the topic. And I love that. I would feel resentful perhaps if I didn't have any friends, because I'd be like, well, I want to talk to this about somebody. But because I do, it's so nice to sort of come away and then come back together.
In fact, that's made me think about, go off on a slight tangent about making friends in your 30s and 40s. I've seen a lot of people my kind of age saying it's so much harder. And yet if we understand that those connections and having lots of friends and nurturing those relationships is good for us, I guess we have to perhaps address the fact that we need to figure out a way of making those connections when we don't have school or office life in the way that we used to, perhaps.
And also that can help us perhaps resent older friends less when we are in different situations, because I had perhaps been less good at that when I was younger. And when I was unhappily single and friends were not only in relationships but having kids, and I just, you know, they were on a completely different part of life to me, of course, did not have as much time. And I felt like I sort of wrestled with that for a long time. But when I then made new friends who were in a similar situation to me, not just having to be single, but just living closer by or in a similar industry, and I, you know, see them, you know, just living life more closely alongside, that allowed me to accept the distance in the older friendships because I wasn't trying to force them into a shape that they just didn't fit anymore. Mm. And Philippa Perry said to me, she said, old friends, new friends become old friends in time too. And she said, when we're younger, we tell everything to one friend because that's, you know, when you're a kid, you do have more of that like best friend at school. And she said, as we grow older, we have to get better at telling different things to different people. And no, you know, one friend doesn't necessarily have time to be all those different things that you need. And I actually love making new friends. I don't know about you. I just love making new friends as an adult. And there's some way in which they are more closely aligned with who I am today. And obviously that will change in the next decade. And I love my older friends and we'll just swap old stories and laugh and be really silly, but they perhaps don't know who I am today as much as some of my newer friends. And that's been a big gift.
I agree. I think making new friends now is getting to sort of extend who you are because you learn from them. But what I've begun to really appreciate, and it must be a time thing, is my friends who have been around for a long time, who know the ugly parts of me as much as they know the good parts of me. And the fact that they're still in my life makes me really cherish them. So I don't necessarily speak to them all the time, but every now and again, I'll think, yeah, I'm just going to send Hannah this, or I'm just because she means a lot to me. We don't speak all the time, but the fact that she's been around for such a long time and is always there is just a lovely feeling.
Oh, I agree. And it does take trust and confidence in those relationships to sort of tolerate the distance. And I think there is that transition between when you are young and you see each other all the time, and there's almost like a natural consistency that you don't have to put into the relationships because you're living together, or I don't know, you know, growing up in journalism together, you're going to all the same events or all that stuff. And I think it is easier to sort of let it drift because it can be quite uncomfortable to feel, I guess, that drifting apart and that distance and that pulling away. So I think if you can tolerate the uncomfortableness of that and then still trust in the love between you, then at the other side of that, you get this amazing, deep, layered, rich friendship. But it has to go through that sort of a bit messy period when it's changing, as all our relationships do. It's the same with your parents, isn't it? As you kind of have to pull away before you can go back to being close. And for me, you know, one of the biggest things that came up again in the book is just accepting, not only accepting, but embracing change in love, which for a long time I resisted, but because it was so scary. But now I see, oh, wow, change is what means that even in a really long-term romantic relationship, you can have this new found romance or love, even after, for me now, 6 years. So in a strange way, the change that I resisted has now been this thing that kind of constantly surprises me and feels like a bit of a gift.
It definitely felt when you were talking about your own relationship in the book that there was a shift in mindset, perhaps, of really trying to see it through his eyes, trying to see the circumstances and actually being really honest with yourself about, am I being 100% fair in this situation? Am I coming at this? Am I being driven by my emotions? Like, what's happening? And I genuinely just thought when you were describing the relationship and the considerations you made towards each other, I thought, God, that, I mean, forget about the notebook. That's the goal. That's the partner that you want, who really thinks about what you're going through and makes considered choices and puts you first whilst not putting themselves second, if that's even physically possible.
Yeah. It's the I and we thing again, isn't it? And annoyingly in love, what you realize is a lot of it just comes back down to self-possessed behavior and consciousness. And when I was younger, I used to think, oh, these men treated me so badly, or, you know, this happened to me. And now I realize there's a lot more that I have to take responsibility for. And that kind of really trying to I just guess empathize with the other person and accept that your feelings are not the only chapter in that story that you're trying to write together is very difficult, because sometimes they'll do something and you think, I wouldn't do it like that. Like Heather Havrileski used the example of her husband moaning about his back, and she's really tough and she has a bad neck and she would never moan about it. So, but she said she can't say, I don't moan about this, so you shouldn't moan about your back, because that's, she says, that's the death of love, because you're just saying, do it my way, when really you just need to tune into what the other person is feeling, encourage them to be honest about it, and then meet them there. Which I'm still struggle with all the time. And then my husband will be like, oh, didn't you write something about this? Damn it. the book means I have to be accountable to this. But I, long-term love has been possibly one of the things that surprised me the most, because I assumed it was this sort of safe companionship, friendship, that it's sort of like was this flame and then it sort of fizzles out. It's how it's sort of spoken about a lot of the time. Yeah. And I don't feel that way now at all. I feel there's always new parts of it that appear and surprise me, and there's always bits of mystery that come into it, and it can still be erotic and new and thrilling even in the longer term, and so I feel grateful to have been surprised by that.
Yeah, because there is this stereotype, and I haven't had a long-term relationship, so there is this stereotype or this sort of idea that it's it just becomes boring. It becomes habit. Once you've been in a couple for a while, you're the couple who walk around the kitchen, don't speak, and one opens the cupboard, the other one takes a mug out, and there's some synchronicity, but it's all somewhat subconscious. Mm. But that's not, doesn't have to be the case. But that's what you're saying takes the work.
Yes, and there is elements of that. I have also found romance in that domestic detail in a way, of much like you, romance to me was that sort of tumultuous, intense, sort of force, mystical force. And now I feel that romance is just, not even in a romantic relationship, but just paying attention to the small details that make life beautiful. Mm. And that could be the way a sea sounds, the way the sea sounds at the night, or this sounds cheesy, but there was like a little leaf caught in a cobweb at night, and the sort of light was hitting it, and I just noticed it, and that felt like a really romantic moment to me, that I was just in tune with nature and noticing something beautiful about the life that I was living. Like, that to me is romance now.
Mm. Because you mentioned something a minute ago, and I made a little note, which is about expectations, because I think I had a bit of a light bulb moment, I would say probably around 18 months ago, when I realized I was unhappy with quite a few people in my life. And I thought they never understand. And this has sort of been, obviously this is just, why is this pattern repeating? And I have a library of books, as you can see, read quite a lot.
Color coded as well.
And I realized it had nothing to do with them. It had to do with my expectations. I wanted to be treated a certain way, and I wasn't being treated that way. And so I was dissatisfied. And so no one else was actually really involved in that equation. Mm. And then shifting my expectations and actually thinking, am I expecting something of someone that they are actually incapable of? Is it like demanding someone speak to me in French when they don't know the language? That's basically how unreasonable I realized I was being on an emotional level. And I've really tried to write that and just accept how people project their love or show me love, even though it might not be to me a language of love. I'm getting caught up in the language thing now, but understanding that it doesn't mean that there's not love there.
Mm. Was this in friendships?
Yeah, mainly, yeah.
Because I felt something similar, and I interviewed a psychotherapist called Charlotte Fox Weber, who you should definitely have on your podcast, by the way. You would get on really well. You would love her. She's writing a book about desire in all aspects of our life. And I said, sort of what we were talking about before, I have some older friends who I had very much like a role in the friendship group that was slightly like the child of the group. And, you know, I was never that domestic, so I wasn't a great cook. And, you know, if we're on holiday, they would choose what we were going to cook in the supermarket. And I would sort of just always go along, almost like the younger sibling. And when I made new friends, I sort of realized that actually, no, I do sometimes want to be in that, not mother in a stereotypical sense, but, you know, take the lead in some situations. I don't always just want to be treated like the child of the group. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not really like that anymore. And I'm also 36 and I've changed a lot from since we were 8 years old. And she said to me, first of all, there is more of a responsibility on you to tell people who you are. So rather than expecting them to see you in a certain way, the next time you were together, you could just say, guys, cancel your plans. I'm cooking. Or I'm going to be the one who, you know, saying to them, not necessarily saying, guys, I feel this way. I never did this. Don't make a big deal of it. Just almost adopt the new role and see how that goes. But the second thing she said is you don't need those friends to necessarily see all those parts of you. She's like, that's, people are going to misunderstand us all the time. Like, we're so complicated. We don't even know all the parts of ourselves. It's so much to expect our friends to see who we are like every year because it's always changing. Mm. So she said, you almost have to know who you are enough for yourself that you don't feel slighted if someone doesn't see all those sides of you, and accept that you do have newer friends who might see that one side of you, but also there might still be that childlike part of you that it's nice to be seen by your older friends too. So she helped me to feel that it's more my responsibility, but also, as you say, that expecting everyone in our lives to know us so completely is unrealistic. And as I said, you know, I'm sometimes surprised myself when I react a certain way to something. I think, oh, that's new. Or, you know, I didn't think I would feel uncomfortable by that, or I didn't think I would enjoy that so much. And I discover new bits about myself all the time. So I think, yeah, I feel like in your situation, sort of the same as mine, like we can shift those things a little bit, but also we can sort of accept them for the relationships they are and enjoy them rather than trying to force them into something that they're not.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And I think the accepting people as they are, but also you said something there, which is quite interesting because it's something I hear a lot in business. Something I hear a lot from my friends who are running their own businesses where they say, teach people how to treat you. Mm. And so it reminded me about what you were saying about friendships and change your role a little bit so that they understand that you're changing and maybe their behavior will adapt. Obviously in business, it becomes a slightly more aggressive and more, well, not aggressive necessarily, but there's definitely more of a directness to it. Yeah, mm. Exactly. But it's true. It's understanding, accepting the relationship for what it is, but also adapting yourself ever so slightly to get the best out of that person's love. Even if it might not be the way that you show love, it's you can actually adapt to really receive that.
And the other example she used, which I found fascinating, was that if you've fallen into a rut, so say there's two friends and one always pays the bill because at a certain point in time they earn more money or I don't know, for whatever reason. She said a lot of people will feel so, if you start to resent that, they will feel so awkward about changing that it might be easier to just let the friendship drift. So rather than thinking, I want to see that person, I think, oh, I don't want to see them because I'll end up paying. And so the friendship fades and ends out. But what she said is you don't need to have a really big conversation and say, oh, I hate that I'm always in the role where I'm paying. She said, you just need to next time make a pact with yourself. You're going to split the bill and show up and just say, we're going 50-50. And again, it's about taking responsibility for how you assert yourself in the relationship without needing to have this big sort of deep conversation about it. But that does take more courage than just letting it end. And with friendships, I think, you know, when you live with someone, you kind of have to make up or resolve the conflict because they're there the next day. But if you don't, it's more fragile, and it's more, you know, one awkward conversation can lead to the beginning of an end of it. So I think asserting yourself in relationship is the best way to put it.
Well, it makes me think about all of the, not all of the conversations, but a lot of the conversations that you hear of, oh, I'm a bit upset with so-and-so because this happened. And it's easier to talk about your uncomfortable emotion with a third party where you can sort of present yourself as the wronged party than it is to actually confront the person with who is in the dynamic with you, who's probably got a sense that something's not quite right, and be vulnerable enough to share that emotion with them and say, I feel this way and I don't want to feel that way anymore, so can we make an adjustment?
Oh, it's so hard, and I'm conflict avoidant. I would do anything, not in my romantic relationship, because it feels safer in that way of, like I was saying, when you have these societal artificial labels put on something, there is a way in that that gives you, you know, it's not real, but a false sense that it's safer. With friendships, I find it so difficult to confront any conflict. I'm terrible at just shutting down. And what I wrote about in the book is, you know, speaking to Susie Orbach about envy, she was saying that, you know, the way you guide yourself through it in the friendship is you have to say, like in my case, I'm so happy that you got pregnant, but it really is hurting me at the same time. And I couldn't do that originally with friends when in the times that I was writing about it. I just sort of ignored their messages and then sort of shut myself away, which was the opposite of how I should have responded. But I think a lot of us feel that way. And so I wanted to be honest about, you know, I'm talking to you now like I know everything. I'm like, no, I struggled to do that and to be vulnerable with friends. But I was able to do it after having some of these conversations and thinking about the risk of losing the relationship was greater than the risk of being vulnerable in the end.
My modus operandi is also just to eject once it gets to a certain point. And I try really hard not to do that now. But and it's actually one of the reasons why I was so glad in the book you address the loss of friendship or the loss of love, but specifically about friendship. And I know you've listened to that podcast with Julia. When friends of mine knew that I was speaking to Julia again, they said, can someone have a conversation about how real and actually sometimes more painful the loss of a close friendship is over a romantic one? Because if I came into the office on a Monday morning and said, I broke up with my boyfriend over the weekend, we would all someone would turn up 20 minutes later with a 12 pack of Krispy Kremes, and there'd be a moment of sort of, let's all comfort Emma. But if I came in and said, I'm never going to speak to my best friend again, I think there would be a much less, some people wouldn't look up from their computers. Some people might say, do you want a cup of tea? But it would be a much less intense reaction, yet the pain of it can be equal, if not more so.
But also, would you say that? Because I don't think whereas I would say I've been dumped, which was, I was like about to say dumped, and I was like, no, I mostly always got dumped. I think I would feel too embarrassed, or just there wasn't a space to come in and say, I feel this friendship has ended. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, I 100%, absolutely.
And also because with friends, again, because there isn't the label, there's less of a sort of, oh, you know, I'm just thinking about being dumped here. It's giving me shivers. You know, when someone breaks up with you and there's just that final conversation, or there's that final email one time, there is a kind of having, they have to almost break it because you've got the label of boyfriend, girlfriend, yeah, girlfriend, whatever it is. But certainly in my friendships, it's so much more subtle because you don't have that label. That almost there isn't necessarily a morning where you think, I broke up with my friend last night. It's a much more subtle drift. So that might be a reason for it too.
Yeah.
Have you written about a friendship breakup?
No, I actually did. I used to get into these really toxic dynamics, and I was complicit. Please don't think that I'm suggesting that they happened to me. I know I've done the work. I know that I was complicit.
It's that responsibility again.
Yeah, so I knew that I would, and I knew that a lot of that stemmed from low self-esteem. And so there were specific dynamics that I got into. But I had to reject on a couple of relationships, and it really hurt. One in particular really hurt because I had invested so much into it and it meant a lot to me. But I also just got to that point where I realized this is no good for me and I'm not going to, and this is it. Like there's almost an element of there'll be a stasis if I stay in this friendship. And for example, I wouldn't have started this podcast. I wouldn't have done the things that I've done since. And I understand that. And I knew that very much at the end of the friendship. But I felt so much regret for how I had let it get to the point that it got to, why I hadn't stood up earlier and all of these things. And I spent more time kind of analyzing the wrongs that I did in that than I have with any relationship.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, I had a childhood friend who I guess was like my childhood best friend. And it was only when I was able to like pull away and go to university that I realized, I wouldn't say it was bullying, but I always felt scared of her. And I'm not sure even on nights out, I'd be scared she would get drunk and get into a fight, or I just was always on edge and always would do what she wanted and just felt very, just scared in the relationship for some reason. And so we sort of drifted away. And then when we were older, she got back in contact with me and I thought, you know, I'm so silly. It's just a younger friendship. Maybe it's nice to make an effort. And when I saw her, I realized it was still the same dynamic. And I still felt scared. Like I said to my husband, he's like, why are you scared? And all those old feelings were there. And I just thought, there is just no point trying to retain this thing that makes you feel so horrible. And again, I felt like I must be a bad person.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Because she really wanted to stay friends and probably had no idea that I saw it as this slightly bullying dynamic. But it has been one of the best things I ever did, just letting that go. And now I'm like, why did I try for so long to make it work? Because we just don't have any time. And there are so many friends who I see them and I feel, you know, I think it was... Philippa Perry, she's saying, you know, relationship or friendships, like when you people see the goodness in you and when you like how you are when you're around them, that is a sign of loving relationship. And I have so many friends, you know, when you walk away from them and you just feel like you've been given a pep talk, or you just feel you can go in there feeling awful and you come out like on such a high. So we don't have enough time to devote to these people who make us feel terrible, and that's just okay. It's nothing to be you know, I think we should just see it as the same as growing out of old clothes in a way. Mm. That's a cringy example. But, you know, I just don't think it has to be a big deal.
Exactly. And actually, you're reminding me of something that happened a few years ago. So when I was at school, I always felt quite invisible. I was not academically great and I was not a sporty person, and in my school if you were academic and you were very sporty then you were great, otherwise you just kind of plodded along and made up the numbers. So I always felt incredibly invisible. And I think that was part of the thing that was like, well, I'm going to go and work for magazines. I'm going to go and do this job. I'm going to.
Yeah.
And so it kind of lit a fire under me that was very productive for me personally. I had lots of goals and ambitions. And then after about what must have been 15 years, I met up with a few of the girls that I had been somewhat close to, but I hadn't seen or really spoken to in well over a decade. And it was such a disappointment in many ways because the dynamic hadn't changed. I'd spoken over and interrupted, and it was as if we were a wolf pack. And even though in other areas of my life, I had a status, or I was able to speak up for myself and I felt confident, as soon as we got back into that dynamic, I was the meek sort of one who didn't really contribute, who was just going to let everyone run free. And it was a really confronting experience, actually, because I thought that I'd done all this work and I'd lived all of this life so that I could then go into any situation and be a certain version of myself. And it was quite a shock to realize, no, actually, there's a lot more at play there.
It's the same as when you go home. And if I, like, during the first coronavirus lockdown, Dan had coronavirus and I was pregnant. So I had gone home for the weekend, and then we agreed, like, I had to stay there because, you know, they closed all the roads. And so I ended up living with my parents for a month, which is, you know, I've never spent more than sort of 4 days. And I just completely found myself being a teenager again. It's like, how is this happening? You know, just reverting into those moments. And there was a side of it that was really fun, and I quite liked being a teenager for a month. But yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, how we can just like shift back into those dynamics and patterns. And the psychotherapist who I was interviewed on Friendship, she also said with school reunions, and with that for you as well, we have this feeling of going back and thinking, I want to prove I'm someone new. You know, I want to show that I'm not that old version, that I'm this. But again, it's more about knowing that for yourself, rather than putting all the self-esteem or value on other people knowing that. Because, you know, it's important to tell people who you are, but it just shouldn't be that if they don't see that version of you, then it's not real.
Mm.
So I guess it's just like separating how you see yourself, being so dependent on those people seeing you in a certain way.
It comes back, doesn't it, to what you talk about a lot in the book and what we've mentioned earlier about this idea of coming back to the self. And I mean, the famous RuPaul quote, how can you love somebody? I always get it wrong now. I need to watch more Drag Race. But how
do you know I've never seen Drag Race? I've never seen it. This is terrible.
Get off my podcast, Dad.
Yeah.
How in the hell are you going to love somebody else if you can't love yourself? Is just, and it's such an easy thing to say, but actually it's really hard work. But it does, it's this thing. And again, Julia mentioned it in the podcast when she came on. She said, if you're an oak and your roots run deep and you know who you are and what you stand for, then that's the basis around which you can create much stronger connections, because they can't damage you.
But I kind of now don't necessarily think that. Because, and it was two people, it's kind of what I was saying to you earlier, that I used to feel like, oh, I don't love myself, so no one else is going to love me. And I think that, you know, when I met Dan, it wasn't that I'd reached this perfect place of self-love and I'd sorted out all my issues. And, you know, I think that's like just as unhelpful a myth as the myth of the one or anything else. And I don't think that any of us will ever get to that point of like total self-love all the time. And so I don't think that you have to love yourself in order for someone else to love you. I think that even if you don't love yourself, someone can love you. If you don't understand yourself, then it can make it very difficult to be in the relationship, and maybe quite hard work for the other person and for yourself. But yes, I don't, there are certainly days when I really don't love myself and I can be quite mean to myself, and Dan doesn't stop loving me because of that. He doesn't find that ugly. He just understands that that's part of being a human for all of us, in the same way that if my friend was just really going through a period where she just was going through some self-loathing, like that wouldn't cut me off from loving her. So I think for me, like Alain de Botton said, it's more about self-understanding than self-love. And obviously self-love is important and we should be aiming for that. But I think it's just another stick we can sort of use to punish ourselves. If we haven't reached it, we're like, well, no one's going to love me because I can't even love myself, was how I felt.
Yeah, you've totally captured it. And actually, I guess on some level, I thought that, because my next note was patterns. And I guess patterns come to understanding. I guess one of my own personal experiences is the patterns of getting into the same dynamic, always being, even though I might have thought I learned my lesson, I would then realize I was getting into another friendship dynamic or whatever dynamic it might have been, thinking this is the same. It happened to a really good friend of mine recently in work, actually. They made a really strong decision a few years ago to leave a particular job for various reasons, and then went into another one having learned the lesson or had the experience that they didn't want to repeat. And unfortunately, the circumstances kind of repeated themselves. So I guess there's a thing there, isn't it? The understanding is understanding what patterns you have and being able to course correct. And that's kind of tricky if you've got such an embedded pattern and a perspective on the world.
And also, where I used to come at with a lot of this stuff was that you need to stop making the patterns and you need to love yourself and you need to kind of value yourself through work and do all these things that mean that you're not sort of as insecure or, you know, harming yourself in these emotional ways. But now I feel that it's more about being kind to yourself when you do those things, and not necessarily thinking that they will, that the fact you do them means that you're never going to have loving relationships. And I had a friend the other day who had an unhelpful relationship pattern, and she's now in a really happy relationship, and she felt like she'd sorted that all out. And then she noticed that it was in a friendship dynamic that she was repeating some of the mistakes, but she transferred it over to a friendship. And so I don't believe that, for me, I will ever let go of like all my flaws or unhelpful patterns. Like, for instance, I guess in my romantic relationships, my issue was like always putting someone else on a pedestal and just thinking that they were going to leave me because I wasn't good enough, you know, all the cliches. And I don't feel like that at all in my relationship. But after I miscarried, I slipped back into that thinking, Dan really wants to be a father. I've taken that away from him because I've got issues. He should, you know, maybe he should have married a woman who hasn't got issues and he would have a child by now. You know, irrational, but that it's the same thing, just on a different level. But then the difference is that time I said it to him. I said, I'm just feeling that I am robbing something from you if I can't, you know, if we can't have children. And as well as my own sadness about this, I was thinking, I don't want, you know, what happens if he could have had a different life without me? You know, all this horrible way of thinking. And that's when I write in the book, he just took my hands and was like, we'll make it if we don't make it. Like, it's not like we'll figure out a plan. If we can't have kids, it'll be something else. And then I kind of come back to me, like, oh, of course, like, we love each other. I feel secure in that, but it's still always there. Like that little niggling, like Philippa Perry said to me as well, you know, I guess it's like, if you have a slightly insecure attachment style, you can kind of move out of it and be secure, but they're always, if something happens, like you have a big loss or like a miscarriage, something can kind of tip you back into that. And I try to be honest about that as well, so that people don't think, oh, you just, you know, you learn about yourself and then you never slip back into that negative way of thinking. And it comes back to the self-love thing, right? Because I think we just need to be as kind to ourselves as possible about what we are really feeling. And that is perhaps a more helpful goal than loving ourselves all the time.
You know what I love about what's not in the book is, well, what is in the book is about this vulnerability, about accepting yourself, about how fragile love can be, how it can be mundane even, and how it's something that you have to work on. Exactly as you said earlier in the show, when you said, you know, you wouldn't expect to get your dream job without doing the work or getting the qualifications or all the steps that you have to do it. You wouldn't just expect that it just arrives. And what I really appreciate is how there's so much noise out there about love, the pursuit of love, and how we've gamified it, how we've almost made it about getting control of a situation, how text somebody in this way to get the upper hand or to get them to show themselves. And I personally, that's why I really don't like dating apps, because I think I don't want to have a gamified conversation where I'm trying to get to the next level. I find it a little bit sort of pointless, and I don't personally enjoy that. Do you notice that as well? And was this kind of the counterpoint to that kind of narrative around love and the pursuit of it?
What I have really found is that for every example, like I used to read a lot about how starting up a fling over email was really bad, because you can craft the perfect email and you can create a persona and you're not really getting to know the other person, so you can sort of live in this online world for so long without actually meeting. And that it was Daniel Jones, the modern love editor, had found that was causing a lot of issues in love, because people just being stringing each other along and almost creating this like false spread. So I was like, you know, this is not a great way to meet someone. And then I interviewed Ariel Levy and Heather Havrileski, and they had both started their relationship on email for a very long time for various different reasons. And I've interviewed a lot of people who said the dating apps, like you, they didn't like them, or they just actually thought it was a really unhealthy way to begin a relationship. Obviously, I did meet Dan on a dating app, so I have a completely different, I'm very grateful for them. And it wasn't any different than having met someone at a party and snog them and get their number and meet them. It's just a different way to facilitate meeting.
Yeah.
So I personally think it's not really about the format of how you meet someone. It's more how honest you are about what you're looking for at that moment in time. And like one relationship coach said to me, we have to get away from thinking about what we're looking for in a partner and think about what we're looking for in a relationship, which is a big difference. So I don't personally feel that the apps in particular have gamified love. I think just gives people more opportunity to meet, which I felt was no bad thing. But then I haven't had negative experiences on them, so it's very easy for me to say that. But I certainly know that lots of people who've never ever been on the apps can be quite down on them without understanding that there can be positive experience too. I feel that if I had had a different experience, I'd probably sit here being like, I deleted the apps and I would never go on them. So I understand. But when you have met someone on there, I just feel like I need to donate something back to happen the dating app.
I always remember Tim Ferriss, and I don't know whether he did it through an app, but he essentially, because he's Tim Ferriss and he's so sort of cerebral and quite organized in that way, he essentially, I think, arranged 12 dates in a day. So I think every 45 minutes and sat in a coffee shop and just kind of had 12 coffees and ended up staying with one of the women for 5 years, I think. But that's what I mean about, I think, oh, great, well, I'll just organize 12 dates and sit in a coffee shop all day and get the jitters. But that's what I mean about gamifying a little bit. But I also mean I'm sort of casting us right back to the rules and
right
third date, all of those things that, I mean, you and I both know. If I say to you, if I said I'm going on a third date with someone, what would your next question be? It would probably be, are you going to sleep with him? Because of the rules.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't really have that when I was dating Dan, because, you know, we didn't actually even kiss until the third date, which is really, really strange. But I was just so, I think the difference is when I had been on a date and I became obsessed with someone, then I would fall into that pattern of thinking, how can I keep them? When should I have sex? All that stuff. But I have found this love to be very slow and quiet and steady and consistent. There wasn't really any space for me to play games, because when someone just does a reply straight away, and I also didn't have that like rush, instant kind of attraction. So I was more like, this is interesting, but not sure. Let's see where it goes. It was very sort of calm, and I was sort of busy with other things and not really thinking about it that much, which perhaps gave space to get to know each other a bit more steadily. But I certainly have, you know, obviously done that in the past, and the WhatsApp tick tick scene, you know, it's so stressful. But I do think we have moved away from the rules type conversation now, I hope. And certainly when I speak to like a lot younger people in my life, they seem a lot wiser about that stuff than we were.
Well, it's to speaking to what you said earlier about infatuation, isn't it? Is that that's kind of something when you're infatuated and you want somebody completely, that's when you can begin to sort of use the rules just to, it's like a trap, isn't it? Essentially, the rules are a trap. How can you lure somebody into your lair almost if you actually read those rules in the book?
Well, also when does that end? Because at some point you have to be honest, and it's so exhausting. It's so tiring. And I guess where I got to, because I had done that so many times and sort of bored myself in the end by this, and was just a certain fearlessness of being much more like, this is my shit, take it or leave it. Mainly because I knew I wanted to have kids, and I felt a bit of time pressure, and that I just don't want to waste another 2 years on someone who frankly just doesn't care about me at all. And realizing that if they don't love me, it's never going to work anyway. So may as well find out now rather than in 2 years' time. And when you can, like Alain de Botton said, actually the best way to approach anything you want, career, relationship, is a certain knowledge that you can walk away from it and still have a good life. And that was my way to pull myself back from all that game playing rules stuff, of thinking, if this does end, life is still good. It's not, I'll be sad, but it's not like if this ends, life is terrible forevermore, which sounds crazy, but was a feeling that I had when someone, you know, I will never meet someone this amazing. He's so clever. He's so amazing. I'll never meet someone like this again. And I feel that even now, when I was trying to get pregnant, trying to get to that place of, if I don't have a baby, it will obviously be so difficult and hard, but I still have a good life. There are still things to appreciate here. And I always try and just go to that place now when I'm struggling with something or when something doesn't go my way.
It's funny. Well, it's not funny for the person who sent the message, but somebody DM'd me when I was doing an Ask Me Anything on Instagram the other night and said, how do you get over heartbreak? And I said, it's so hard to say when you're not in it, but I hope that next time I'm going through it subjectively, I'm able to be objective and remember that even though what I thought was real is now no longer, you know, the future I might have envisaged for myself is no longer there. Maybe I choose to think that the future that now lies ahead of me is one that is so much better.
And it's such a hard conversation to have, isn't it? Because I know that some people like Melanie Reed, who I've interviewed, like she would of course take back her accident and walk. And you can't say, oh, your life is more meaningful now because you've had this accident, because of course she'd take that back, and there would have been meaning in her other life. But the way I try to think about it now is that the meaning, it was a Sheila Hetty quote, she said the meaning comes from what you apply to your life rather than the choice or the circumstance. So whatever happens, whatever option, it's how you apply meaning to the life you've got that makes it a good, happy life, not necessarily the thing that happens to you. So you could have a baby or you could not, and either would be full of joy or sorrow, but it's how you choose to apply meaning to that choice that makes it what it is. That's a very long-winded way of saying it. Do you understand?
Yeah, it's like Miss Havisham, isn't it? Upstairs wearing the wedding dress, being sad about the life that never was.
Mm.
And so staying in this position of stasis and this, oh, I'm so sad that didn't happen, rather than moving on and becoming something else.
And just understanding that, you know, I think that the worst place you can fall into, which is certainly what I've done, is like looking at other people and thinking, oh, but they got this and I didn't. And it's having these conversations and putting them all side by side and sort of pulling back, I guess, from my own life and seeing the ways that we're connected and all these kind of different sad and happy experiences that so many people have had, is understanding that all of us will have suffering, and that just because you're suffering at that particular point in your life doesn't mean that you're alone or kind of treated unfairly or in a much worse position than everyone else. And in my situation, because I haven't had anything obviously really traumatic happen to me, I am now, like, I was thinking about if I was 13, what would I have chosen? I would have probably chosen to meet someone at 16, terrible, and get married in my early 20s. And I have like 3 kids by now, living by the sea, probably with 2 dogs. I don't know, I'd be working at Vogue, all these things that maybe I had dreamed of. And now the reality that I have now is so much better than anything I could have written, or the partner that I had imagined would be very different to Dan. But it just, reality has continued to surprise me and be more interesting and rewarding than all the fantasies I had. So I feel, yeah, pretty grateful for that. Thank God I got so many dumped so many times.
Well, it's just funny, I was doing a podcast yesterday with Lisa Bilyeu, and we were talking about failure and how failure is just, it's like the tears in the muscle when you're trying to grow muscle. It's like you have to go through failure to get sometimes a great result. And you know, there's the famous saying, you have to kiss a lot of frogs. But actually, I think it's more profound than that. I think it's that you have to know what hurts you, what nourishes you, in order to then get to a point where you can build a meaningful connection with somebody where you don't feel hurt and you do feel nourished, or where the pain is minimized and the nourishment is maximized.
And also, just as I was saying to you about friends, when you kind of feel all those layers, when all those arguments, or and you feel like the depth of the friendship now, if I look at Dan now, I see the time that he hold my hand in a hospital waiting room, or the time where we had this really painful fight and then came back together, or the time when I was throwing up and he held my head, you know, all those painful times or difficult times, now add this like richness to the relationship that I don't, you know, there's a closeness that you forge through suffering through stuff together, which if you never have any of that stuff, I just don't think that we would have the same level of intimacy. If I hadn't, you know, held him as he cried for the first time, or you know, all those things that I would have skipped or fast forwarded, now form a love that's deeper.
Yeah. And it's funny because it's just made me think about, I just before I came on here, I was on Instagram and I think one of the Kardashians had put up yet another massive flower wall from a boyfriend or something. And I find that quite grotesque. But I mean, obviously for someone that might be, oh, that person showed me that they love me because they've bought me several £1,000 worth of roses and had them organized into the, to look like my initials. I don't know, maybe. But actually, you're right. I mean, that's, I'm sure there is meaning in that too, but actually the meaning that you take from somebody kneeling with you by the toilet when you're puking up and holding your hair back and wiping, like that's so intimate, and that's such a lot of caring, and that's really beautiful.
Yeah. And with friends too, the reason that old friends are special, like you were saying earlier, is because you've held each other's hands through the breakups. And you know, from my friends now, like people's parents dying and all those and I would say lots of people when I've interviewed and said, when they have something like a parent dying, it is their old friends that are there at the funeral and they feel just so close to, and however busy their lives, they sort of showed up in that moment. And you know, because old friends, you tend to know each other's parents and there's that level of intimacy there. But those friendships having all those ruptures and distance and sadness is what makes them feel so special now, those old friends. And I feel that depth in those relationships more and more the older I get.
Mm. I guess it's just, I think definitely listeners, what the book did, and congratulations on the book, because if you haven't guessed already, I thought it was magnificent. But it really does get you to realize how much you already have, how much love is already in your life that you might be taking for granted or you weren't necessarily seeing as love. And so that's a really lovely thing to read and actually think, God, actually, it really is in every part of my life. And I came away from it feeling really fortunate that I had the experience of taking note of it. It's almost a little bit like, you know, that thing where you get a little bit older and then you find an old toy and you realize how much you love it and you want to just, it means so much to you. I guess I had a similar sort of emotional experience to realizing, yeah, I have a lot more love than I think I thought, because my definition of love was inadequate. And this allowed me to create a far more adequate definition of love and how it shows up for me and how I show up for it.
Do you feel that there is love in creating the podcast? And because when I was listening to your Julia Samuel, I was like, here, this is love. It's like you're both trying to understand something together and be truthful to each other and find meaning. And that was how I found when I was having some of the interviews that we were obviously talking about love, but the interviews themselves became this form of love. Do you feel that with your podcast?
I feel such a connection when I'm having conversations with people, even over Zoom, which has obviously been quite a big shift. I've only met Julia over Zoom. I absolutely want to meet her in person because we really connected, and I absolutely do. So actually it's quite funny, because if someone comes on the show and we stay in touch, that feels very right. But if someone comes on the show and they just came on the show to do an interview, I actually feel quite rejected.
I
stings a little bit, because I feel as though I've been vulnerable and open and like, hey, come to my house. And if there's not kind of, if it doesn't seem as though they enjoyed it, or they're that I it stings a little bit. I'm not saying that happens very often, listeners, but yes, I do. In answer to your question, I invite people on that I think I can have a meaningful conversation with that will be helpful for the listener, and will find the person that it needs to find, the person who needs to hear it. That's always who I've got in the back of my mind. And so yes, it does feel like a loving connection with people when they really share.
Because that was a love that I, you know, obviously there's forms like friendship and family that I expected to come across. But that sort of, I wouldn't use the word work, because that can be unhelpful to see work as love. But I guess purpose is how I describe it. And Sarah Hoppola talks about how she had it through writing and reading. And she says it's like, when you're being seen in words, or when a reader reads something and thinks, okay, I'm not alone in this, me too, that's like she calls it like a union of souls. And that's the same with what I'm doing and what you're doing, isn't it? You are showing yourself to your listeners and trying to be honest, and then hopefully they will listen and then feel less alone. And yeah, I have come to understand that as a really vital and important form of love. And going back to like the I and we thing, I think that's another thing that can help you to retain the sense of I, having some purpose outside of your relationships.
100%.
And I never would have thought that was love when I was younger, but actually it's something that I really, really appreciate, having Cole for that as like another way of knowing myself. And like forming new connections all the time too, and new friends. I'm sure you've made friends through your podcast as well.
Absolutely. And it's yeah. it's so funny, because I've made international friends. So it's like the world has got bigger just for being, just for opening up. So I guess it comes back to what you talk about, what we've talked about here and also in the book about vulnerability, saying, hey, can I talk to you about this thing that I know is really important to you? And then all of a sudden you realize that 2 years later, you're still chatting, and as soon as you can fly again, you're going to go and visit. It's just so lovely.
And there's one line which I think about all the time, where a psychotherapist said to me, love is a frequency you can choose to tune into or ignore. And so as well as it being like the choice you make with people in your life, it's also just so hard to talk about this without sounding cheesy, but it's basically how you decide to move through the world that day. So do you, like, even if I'm when I'm good at this, if I'm just walking past a person, there's a difference in the way that I can smile and like be open to them, or I can just be stressed and like shut down and not really look at them. And that sounds really small, but when you can sort of tune into that way of being, it does really change everything. And I have felt like from strangers, that form of kindness or generosity, especially in a vulnerable moment, feels so much like love, and all is love. And that was another form of it I was overlooking.
The story, and I won't go into it here because I appreciate that we're drawing to the end of our time together, but the story you tell, and I'm guessing it was the barista in Eat. Was it Eat?
Pret,
yeah. Yeah. That story in the book was really moving.
Yeah. Yeah, because that I think it's funny, everyone picks that out, but we all have, like everyone I ask has those moments, and that maybe you just forget them and you don't notice them in a way you would, like your first kiss or like more traditional milestones in love. But so many people I've spoken to, when they were really sad or vulnerable, something, some small gesture from someone they didn't know was just something that kind of saved them in some small way. And I think that becomes more and more important as you grow older. When you're younger, I think it's harder because you're so much more egotistical that you're maybe not looking up and out as much. Certainly, well, yeah. I was anyway. So that's definitely a big form of love.
It reminded me as well when I was diagnosed with depression and started reading up on it hugely. And obviously there's a lot of science and data and medical stuff out there, but there's also the thing saying, you know, it is a choice how you show up in the day. You can see the negative or you can see the positive. And obviously there's a huge breadth of wisdom in and amongst all of that. But that was something that I remember reading a book and the author said, look up now, or next time you're outside, look for everything that's red. And all of a sudden you realize that you see more red because you've made a connection. You've made a conscious choice to see red. And it's the same with negativity. So if you go out into the world and you think that people are rude in the supermarket or people are going to cut you up on the road, perhaps that's what you'll see more of. And I think what the book definitely did was, I don't think I'd ever really been looking or choosing to see love.
Yeah.
Consciously. And it, made me realize how easy it is just to make that choice to see it and to lean into it.
Yeah, but also how easy it is to not make that choice. Mm. And lots of people have said to me, oh, because of the pandemic, now we really appreciate people again, and we know how much friendships matter, and we know how much we want to see our family. And that is amazing. But I also fear that we will forget that so easily again.
Yeah.
And it comes back to what we're saying at the beginning, is we just need reminders all the time. Like we do have that ability, but we just lose it. And I think that's okay. It's just, you know, much like you set a reminder, or like you have a review at work, or you have certain like structures in place in your life, anniversaries or things that help you check in on people. I think we just need to put those in for other relationships in some way. Like I'm even thinking now, my friendships, I want to have some sort of annual or quarterly meetup in place so that time just doesn't pass without us seeing each other. I guess it's about forcing those reminders in somewhere.
Well, listeners, I'm sure you've gathered that the book is brilliant. The book really is brilliant. It was. Oh,
thank you, Emma.
I was so intimidated because I've worked with you, Tash, and I know that you are such a brilliant interviewer and such a brilliant writer. And so I thought, oh gosh, is this going to go way over my head? And it really didn't at all. It's so accessible and it's so beautifully told. And I really love the structure and the brilliant guests that you're, I'm saying guests, the brilliant people that you have throughout the book, but also your own story. So thank you so much for your time and for sharing your insights on this. And I can't wait to see what you do next, actually.
Having a break.
A well-earned break. Listeners, the links to Tash and the book Conversations on Love will be in the show notes, and obviously to your social media. But thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Emma. I feel so honoured. I feel like an imposter. I feel like I've waffled a bit and you've been very eloquent, but thank you.
Not at all. Come back anytime.
Thanks, Emma.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Tash and me. If you want to get in touch with me, email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Or you can DM me on Instagram and Twitter, where I am at Emma Guns. Or most excitingly, please do come and join the Facebook forum. The link to join is in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. Click the link, answer a couple of questions. There are thousands of us in there chatting away about all sorts of subjects. And we're making some changes in the Facebook group to get it even busier. So join now so you don't miss out. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.